All right, let's bring the meeting to order, the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee, and start off with a roll call.
Chairman Cornyn.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn. Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Howe. Representative Lomer. Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger.
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Pinto. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zaras.
Thank you, and we'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes of February 22nd.
Mr. Chair, accept the minutes from February 22nd.
Okay, Representative Ward moves the minutes for February 22nd. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay.
Yep.
Okay, Representative Heinzman, House File 192. Move your bill, House File 192, for bring in front of us and lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any amendments?
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Representative Heinzman, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill forward. Some of you may remember it from last year when my constituent, Sue Vanek, came with me and we discussed an issue that affected the Vanek family and her daughter Macy Kavanaugh and her granddaughter Sophia in January of 2015. There was a situation that occurred that I'll just briefly describe. An individual who'd had a especially poor driving record, 9 suspensions in total, crossed the center line with his pickup and impacted Macy and Sophia, causing Macy Kavanaugh to now be in a persistent vegetative state, and Sophie, over the course of 99 days, had almost 20 surgeries repairing and trying to restore her body. So the first focus, of course, of family is taking care of the family and trying to resolve those issues and deal with the financial difficulties. And then the second part of that is, okay, what are the criminal implications of what may or may have taken place? And what we found was that after causing great bodily harm and doing so, while driving illegally, the gross or the maximum penalty allowed was a misdemeanor. And in many cases where alcohol is involved, totally different story. Where drugs is involved, totally different situation. But in the case of a suspended license, we're looking at the law, and the opinion is that there needs to be an enhancement and hopefully some opportunity for people to realize that just driving without a driver's license is not okay. So what this bill essentially does is if you are found to be driving for the third time without a driver's license, instead of a misdemeanor, it would be changed to a gross misdemeanor. And in the case of causing great bodily harm, it would be the same situation. It would also change to a gross misdemeanor. So that is a number of the significant details, and I would stand for questions.
Okay, Representative Heinzman, thank you. Representative Considine.
Thank you. Representative Heinzman, I think I misunderstood this, but they wouldn't have to be driving the third time after revocation and then cause bodily harm. If they caused bodily harm, it would go into effect right away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'll clarify. So if you're driving with this language, if you're driving with a suspended license, so essentially if you're driving without a driver's license, you would immediately be giving a judge the opportunity to charge, or a prosecutor, excuse me, to charge a, or to bring in a gross misdemeanor.
And, Mr. Chair, I would tell you I'm very supportive of this. Reminds me of the one that I put through after my brother was killed in 2014, where the guy blew through a stop sign and was charged with a misdemeanor. When somebody is breaking the law, it's no longer an accident. It's, they have done something illegal to perpetrate this tragedy. So I'll vote for it.
Okay. Any other questions for the members? If none, the chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Scott, House File 179.
I can't hand out that, Mr. Chair. I do have a handout. Is that all right to give to the page?
You bet. Thank you. The chair will move House File 179 to move to re-refer and go to GovOps. And we have Representative Scott. We have amendments A4 and A5. I, as chair, can move A4 amendment. Get it in the shape the author would like. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. And then the chair will move the A5 amendment to get the bill in order that the author would like. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Okay. A4 and A5 have been added to the bill. Representative Scott, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to explain the A4 and the A5 and what they do. The A4 requires that ignition interlock vendors provide separate notice to program participants that the ignition interlock device has location tracking abilities. And then the A5 allows the location tracking capabilities to turn to be turned on if there's a court order to do so. And so that I'll go ahead and explain the bill. The letter that I am passing out is just a letter that was written, as you can see, in September of last year from Representative Dibble and Representative Latz, and I just have a little bit of a reference in my opening comments to that, so I just wanted to have members have that in their hands. The Ignition Interlock program became law in 2010. It has been a great success and no doubt has saved countless lives by disabling the car of program participants when they have attempted to drive after consuming alcohol. People who had their driver's licenses canceled or revoked due to one or more DWI offenses can volunteer, although for some people the program is mandatory for certain offenses. They can participate in the Ignition Interlock program and have certain driving privileges reinstated. This allows the participants to get to their jobs and to treatment and so forth. This last year, we learned that the Department of Public Safety had a new requirement that all devices be wireless in order to provide real-time reporting. And you cannot have wireless reporting without location gathering or tracking technology. So although my staff and I have discovered by talking to five of the vendors that are certified here in the state of Minnesota that some vendors' devices, most of them in fact, can turn off the GPS technology and still provide real-time reporting, the fact remains that the Department of Public Safety made a significant change in the program that may have violated certain program participants' rights by not informing them that they were potentially being tracked. I believe the department should have sought a change in law to make this happen, to make this change. Since this revelation, the Department of Public Safety, and this is what the letter alludes to, ignored requests and recommendations of legislators and stakeholders set aside the January 1st, 2017 implementation of this new requirement until it could be more fully vetted. Only an injunction issued by as a result of a lawsuit brought by one of the vendors that called into question the possible constitutional violations of this requirement finally stopped the implementation of this new requirement. So what my bill does is it requires any new rules regarding just this ignition interlock program to have legislative approval. This bill also prohibits the use of devices equipped with location tracking capabilities unless the location tracking capabilities are disabled. This still allows DPS to have real-time reporting, which is what they were asking for. During the first week of session, the Civil Law Data Practices Committee called a fact-finding hearing on this matter. We asked DPS why they wanted real-time reporting and the ability to track participants. They stated they had no interest in tracking participants. They merely wanted the report of someone who blew a bad blow in real time so that these participants can be notified as soon as possible to let them know that their violation, their time on the program, had been extended. And DPS testified that this real-time reporting would cut down on recidivism, and they stated a couple of studies that showed that. You may hear today from testifiers that location tracking can be a useful tool in stopping a participant who may be driving drunk and even have children in the back seat. Laws in other states may provide that you can send out law enforcement and have these people located and stop them. That's not the law in Minnesota right now. And the Department of Public Safety and what we learned in our hearing, that wasn't what they were seeking for. In fact, I don't even know if they have the personnel that would make that something that they could do. But nonetheless, even if they could, I believe that would require a change in this law, because it is a significant change in the program. I'm not making a judgment on whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, just that I think that it would take a separate law to do that. So in summary, this bill is brought because program participants simply can't have the rules changed midstream through the program, and that the Department of Public Safety shouldn't be making significant changes to this program without oversight and transparency. And those are my opening comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members want to ask questions now, or wait till the other two testifiers are done?
I'll wait.
Okay. The other testifiers, Representative Scott?
I believe there are some that have signed up. They haven't notified me, but I think there are some.
Okay. Are you Benjamin? All right.
Yes.
If you want to state your name and title and begin, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Feiston, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. And I want to thank Representative Scott for bringing forward this bill today. I think it's timely and important to have this discussion. At the outset, I'd like to say the ACLU of Minnesota does not oppose the Ignition Interlock program itself. It's very important public policy to keep drunk drivers off the road. The problem that we have is expanding that program that everyone understands is for the purpose of deterring drunk driving and turning it into yet another location tracking device. That creates a significant intrusion into the privacy rights of Minnesotans, as we've seen with several other types of technologies in recent years, such as automatic license plate readers, cell phone tracking, and various types of warrantless surveillance. The most intimate details of our lives, such as where and how we worship, the people with whom we associate, and where and when we receive medical care, can easily be ascertained by the government via GPS tracking of our vehicles. We do take this very seriously. Look back to the U.S. Supreme Court, U.S. v. Jones, where the Supreme Court unanimously found that attaching a GPS device to a vehicle to track its movements constitutes a search under the Fourth Amendment. And in giving this some thought, the act of putting on an ignition interlock device that has GPS capabilities and is using that tracking capability is very similar to what was happening in Jones, where officers without a warrant placed a tracking device under a car in a manner of trespass. Now, accordingly, the government should have a warrant based on probable cause before obtaining this type of information. And I understand that with the amendments that's been put on this bill now, there would be the possibility of a court order, and that I haven't been able to fully vet, but could certainly pass a congressional muster if done appropriately. So with that, again, we support the bill and hope that it can move forward, and I'll have the committee's support. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, seeing none, thanks very much for your testimony. Representative?
I can wait till the end.
Okay.
I got a couple.
Okay, the next testifier would be Mark Hosey, Go ahead, your name and title, and begin, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mark Hosey, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, or MACDL. I'd also like to state that MACDL does support the use of the ignition interlock. It's a good public safety tool. And actually, one of the concerns that we had when we learned about this new, the impact of this new technology and the GPS tracking was that some people may be concerned, some people who otherwise would use the program may be concerned about this component of it and not enter it. You know, that those concerns may be very real, for example, for somebody who's in some type of a civil suit. For example, if there's a difficult child custody case going on, the way the program is working prior to the court order is that somebody in that case could collect that information about where that person has been traveling. And we have also heard that this is not just speculation, but we have heard that from the representatives of at least one of the companies that they've had subpoenas for that type of information. We're also concerned about, as Representative Scott covered, the way the process was carried out and there was not enough public input. It's become clear that there may be some very good uses for this technology that could protect the public safety purpose. If somebody's driving and they have a fail while they're driving, they may be putting people at jeopardy, and there should be consideration for how that might be used properly to serve public safety interests. However, as the process is going right now, it's difficult to have a full understanding and discussion about the best way to address that. And MACDL would be happy to work with other stakeholders to find that solution. But at this point, we support Representative Scott's bill as it was unamended. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Hosey? Okay, seeing none, is there any other public testimony or any in opposition? Okay. Representative Hilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, I had some amendments that were in your packet. Representative Scott has attempted with her two amendments to take care of some of my concerns. I want to make it very clear that she doesn't take care of all of them. And so while my amendments are currently out of order because of the amendments that she's placed on the bill, you can expect to see those amendments again in another place. So I have some questions for Representative Scott.
Representative Hilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, based on the amendments that you have placed on the bill, is it correct that unless you have a specific court order, if someone is currently driving the ignition interlock and blows a dirty, that you cannot find out where that person is?
Representative Scott.
That's correct, and that's current law.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, isn't it true that you are taking away the Commissioner of Public Safety's authority to make any change about how to best use this program to ensure public safety?
Representative Scott?
No, that's not true. We're just saying they need to come to the legislature to make significant any changes in the ignition interlock program. They need to come before the legislature to make any of those changes.
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, isn't it correct that under current law as it sits right now, anyone who is convicted of a DWI related to a chemical issue, not alcohol, so methamphetamine, heroin, any of those items, they can be on the ignition interlock program. However, the ignition interlock program cannot test for that substance.
Representative Scott.
I don't know the answer to that question, Representative Hilstrom.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, isn't it true that the rules that you are putting in place would prohibit the Commissioner of Public Safety from making any changes related to qualification of the programming based on you taking away their rulemaking authority?
Representative Scott.
Representative Hilstrom, no. I'm not taking – they just have to come to the legislature. We give our authority away to these agencies quite frequently, and then we get situations like this that come back where agencies have taken action, making a significant change in a program, putting a potential tracking device on someone's device when they were unaware, and that's basically not what they signed up for. I think I'm pretty justified in making this change, and I think you're going to see a lot more of agencies no longer having rulemaking authority in a lot of different areas, and I'm just making them subject to the legislature in this one area.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Filsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this program has been very controversial over the years in this committee. The ignition interlock program incentivizes someone who has been convicted of a crime or who is currently pending criminal prosecution for DWI if it's their second DWI or if they tested more than double the legal limit. Actually, Kurt Dowd, as speaker, in the campaign sent out campaign literature stating that DFL members, when they voted in favor of the ignition interlock, were encouraging DWI offenders to be back on the street, and that we were actually making it easier for that to happen. So, members, this program is not without controversy. It's not without politics. But what I want members to know and understand is what this bill actually does. What it says is the Commissioner of Public Safety, who is charged with ensuring public safety, can make no rules related to this program unless it specifically comes to the legislature. Now, when it comes to the ignition interlock program, this statute, if passed by this committee, will make it so that anyone who blows dirty, so they have a DWI, maybe two, or they tested over the legal limit, they are currently driving, and they violate the rules, and they test dirty, it would preclude the commissioner from changing the rules about how it is that those offenders should be dealt with unless there's a specific court order. So, members, here's what will happen. Law enforcement that wants someone to be tracked will go and get a subpoena, a tracking subpoena, and they'll turn it on, and the offender who is driving in the vehicle won't know about it. That's how GPS tracking devices work. Members who need to be tracked, you can track through GPS using a SCRAM bracelet. So folks who need to be tracked can be ordered to use a SCRAM bracelet instead of ignition interlock. What happens then if you're on a SCRAM bracelet? It doesn't make your car stop working if you're driving drunk. It doesn't. So now you have the ability for folks to say, you know, we don't want to use ignition interlock because we're not going to know where they are. Basically what happens if you have a violation, most of the time you get an extension of the time on the program. That's what happens. You get an extension on the time of the program. Members, 1 in 6 Minnesotans currently has a DWI. We hear that there are more crashes all the time related to alcohol, and we know that most fatalities are related to alcohol. So what you're saying is, Commissioner of Public Safety, you don't know what's best for public safety when it comes to drunk drivers. That's the message that you're sending with this bill.
Chair Cornish, thank you. Representative Hillstrom, while I appreciate your comments, everything that you mentioned there would require a change in law. If you want to get rid of the ignition interlock program, then bring a bill. The department has testified in my committee that they like the program. So if you want to make those changes and make the laws tougher on drunk drivers, bring a bill. It wouldn't even probably come to my committee. It would just be a matter of the people in this committee right here deciding that. And then obviously going through that process. But if you want to make the laws tougher on drunk drivers, go right ahead. This bill is very narrowly focused. It just says that the people that are on the program have to be aware that there's a GPS device or a location tracking device on their ignition interlock. They're just making them aware that that's happening. And then we're saying on this program, because the department took such a wide step in putting a location tracking device on someone's ignition interlock program without their knowledge in most cases, that now it would be wise for the department to come before the legislature to make changes. And if you said that the ignition interlock program is not without controversy, all the more reason to bring it before the legislature when they want to make changes in the program.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I was trying to look up. I believe last session, I had an amendment on one of the bills that passed that, unlike what Representative Hillstrom said, this interlock program is only for alcohol-related offenses, not drug-related offenses. I was just trying to double-check, see if that passed or not. I'm still looking at that. But Representative Hillstrom also stated that people are driving. The interlock system is designed so before you start your car, You have to blow into the machine. If it detects any alcohol, it will not allow the car to start, so you'll not be able to drive. That's not stopping them from getting into a car that doesn't have an interlock device, but by law, they cannot drive a car without an interlock device. In fact, we have commercial vehicles that have them placed in them because the employee has to have it in order to drive. So saying that the person that with the GPS in the interlock is going to stop them from driving drunk is false, because if they test anything in their system, the car is inoperable.
Representative Considine. Oh, Representative Scott.
Thank you. And Representative Johnson, you're right that the car won't start, but they do have these rolling tests. So it is possible for somebody to get in, have a bucket of booze beside them, and that is a possibility. So I'm just saying, but if the department wants, or anyone in this room wants to change that law, to make that so if there's these rolling breath tests that they have to take, if you want to change that law and say, you know, hey, Department of Public Safety, you need to look into making that that allowable and make the devices capable of doing that, as it is in some states, then that's under the discretion of, I would say, your committee, Public Safety Committee.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the questions or statements was, is they are not inoperable, all yet they just can't start. So once you breathe, you can drink all you want as you're rolling down the highway. The guy from the ACLU, could you come back? You were talking about probable cause for, these are people that are already convicted. I mean, this is a privilege that's being extended to them. Frankly, one I'm not terribly keen on. Why would you need probable cause post-conviction?
Mr. Feist?
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine.
Considine.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Considine. The issue here, from the ACLU perspective at least, is that even in those cases where you have someone with the drunk driving conviction, and even if there is an agreement to participate in the program, you really need a nexus between the conduct that you're trying to prohibit and the type of surveillance that someone is under. You don't give up all of your constitutional rights to your location, for example, in that process that you, even if you have been through a criminal process with DUI. So we see it as a different issue. And the idea of location tracking itself is what we're really focusing on here.
Follow-up?
I actually have a couple more questions, but just on that, I guess that particularly with the number of people that are slaughtered on the highway every year from drunk drivers, that I think if you've been convicted a couple of times, that some of those maybe constitutional rights until you've proven yourself are suspended. We're suspending their right to drive. Representative Scott, your A5 amendment would require a court order to activate the tracking device?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Considine. Right. There are certain judicial districts right now that are doing that now. They're issuing a court order, and this is done mostly outstate from my understanding. They're already issuing some court orders in certain cases where they require that the tracking device be turned on.
So this could be a condition of sentencing immediately and just say, okay, you got this, and by the way, we are imposing the location device?
It could be. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't understand the nuances between what the commissioner has the capability to do and the courts have the ability to do, but my understanding is, yes, in the sentences in these particular judicial districts, and maybe even Representative Hillstrom could clarify this,
that is being done now in some judicial districts in certain cases. But the people are notified ahead of time that that's happening.
Representative Councilman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other problem I guess I'm having with this is that if they do try to start the car and they blow and it is dirty, they are in violation of the law. And I would say about 90% of the cases, maybe 100, because it's almost always a condition of probation, that they can't drink. So they have broken the law again. And it seems to me that at that point, you'd want to know exactly where they are so you can go pick them up, because they've broken the law again. And I don't really have a problem with that, to be honest.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Constantine. I don't disagree with you, but that would require a change in law. That's not what this bill is about. It's just about notifying the people on the program that their device has a location tracking technology on it, and then it's addressing the rulemaking process for the Department of Public Safety. So they would need to come and make those changes, or someone would need to bring a bill to make that change. You could bring a bill to make that change.
Representative Hilsman, well, do you have a follow-up, Representative Constantine?
I think she's got the same one.
Well,
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Scott, right now there is the authority to have that tracking on. And so you are taking away a tool that they currently have. You're not putting parameters around it. You're not saying you can only have tracking on if they've violated. You're prohibiting. You're saying right now there's tracking, the capability of doing tracking. There's nothing in the law that prohibits the tracking. You're saying, no, we're not going to have them tracked, and the only time you can track is when they're a court order. So you are specifically ordering in this bill that anyone who violates the law by blowing dirty can't be GPS tracked unless there's a court order saying that you can find out where they are. So you are the one that is actually taking away the authority that is currently in law.
Representative Scott, before you answer, I don't think that's accurate. There was many of us duped in the legislature by this bill. We didn't know that the tracking was allowed, so I wouldn't say they have the authority, because authority is usually given to them where we didn't realize we were given to them. It's kind of like the rules that we talked about. The agencies have gone hog wild with these rules, and that's why we're getting more fussy about it, and they're running away with their authority. So having knowledge that we were kind of duped into this, didn't realize the tracking was being involved, now we're kind of, Representative Scott, trying to bring it back to center and saying, you know, there's lots of things we can do, but there's some people that take invasion of privacy real serious and weigh that against, you know, the consequences also. So. Representative Scott.
Yeah, I don't have anything really to add to that. I don't see that this bill is making that change. And, you know, House Research, maybe they want to weigh in. I don't know. But I'm just trying to make some clarifications to the people that are on the program and then to the department that if they want to make changes to the program, to come to the legislature to do so.
Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm not in favor of putting tracking devices in everybody's car, but when somebody's had two or three DWIs and may have maimed or killed some people, I don't think that that's such an imposition on their constitutional right to privacy.
It's just a scary thing to think about. There's lots of people that we could put tracking devices on, you know, for various crimes, and it might benefit. But then you go back to weighing the invasion of your privacy against, you know, the crime. And so, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, just something that Representative Constantine stated about people on probation. Yes, there's a few of the people that are doing the interlock while they started the interlock while on probation, but a lot of them, by the time well into their interlock contract at 3 years, they are no longer on probation. And it's a serious invasion of their privacy, and they agreed to do the interlock not in order to get their driving privileges back. Driving is not a privilege. It's not a right. It's a privilege that we give. if we're really concerned about multiple DUI offenders, maybe we should look at what the length of the revocation is, and do we give those with multiple DUI offenders, do we ever give them their driving privileges back if they cannot control their alcohol consumption?
Members, we've got research that discovered some incompatibility with the A4 and the A5, so what we would like to do is reconsider each one, and then once we do, have the research walk through and tell us why. I think it's a technical fix that we need. So the chair will move that motion to reconsider the A4 amendment to bring it before us again. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the chair will also consider. I want to amend it before we bring them before. Okay. The A4 amendment is before us. Maybe have research walk through and tell us what the deficiency is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We have identified a conflict in the amendments. Currently, the A5 amendment actually deletes all of Section 2, and that was not the author's intent here. So in order to reconcile all of these amendments and put this bill in the form that the author wants, regarding the A4 amendment, what we would need to do is, on the original bill, page 2, lines 21 and 22, we would be deleting that language, which is currently paragraph C. The A4 amendment would stay identical in terms of its current language, except that it would now become the new paragraph C. I've heard a request to repeat the last thing I said, but the current A4 amendment would stay in its identical language, but it would become the new paragraph C, essentially replacing page 2, lines 21 and 22 in the original bill.
Does everyone understand that? And this doesn't really change the intent or action of the two amendments, it just clarifies?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. All right. And then that's the only amendment we have to do. Okay, this would be the amendment to the A4. Everyone understand? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, now reconsider the A. Pass the A4. Okay, now that we have the A4 amended, bring it before a vote. Pass. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, now motion to reconsider the A5 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, now research on A5.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and representatives, the change to the A5 amendment will be to delete the language that's currently on page 1, line 2 of that A5 amendment and replace it with page 2 after line 23, insert. Again, the actual content of the amendment doesn't change in any way, but this will become the new Section 2.
Section 3 and renumbered.
Do everyone understand?
Or excuse me, it's new Section 3 and then renumbered.
Okay, I don't see any head shaking, so all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, now the vote on the A5 amendment as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, now it's all clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any more questions? Or any testifiers, anybody in the crowd? I think I asked that once already. Chair will renew his motion to move House File 179 as amended to government operations. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, motion carries. Thank you, Representative
Scott.
Now your next bill House File 857. The chair will move that and to re-refer to civil law. Okay, it's before us, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 857 is the Department of Corrections bill that allows data that is currently shared amongst entities within the Department of Corrections system to continue to do so for case planning purposes. The bill does not reclassify any of the data that is currently classified as private. So I'll let the testifier speak to the need and from there.
You, ma'am, state your name and title and
sure. Good morning. My name is Kathleen Lonergan. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Department of Corrections, and thank you for letting me speak today, and thank you, Representative Scott. For the past few years, the Department of Corrections has been moving towards a philosophy called Transitions from Prison to Community. And as part of our philosophy and the new programs that we're doing within our facilities, we want to coordinate our case plans that our case managers are working on with our partners in community corrections. So we're just taking our case plans that we're currently putting together, adding them to our statewide supervision technology system, and coordinating so that the agents can see that the offender in prison has taken CD treatment, sex offender treatment, job training, maybe taken certain classes, so that when they go into the community, they're able to be able to put that offender into the right programming in the community. If they need additional CD treatment, they can see what CD treatment they already had. And we're putting it in, part of the bill also keeps that data that's currently private. But we're going to be working with Representative Scott on some amendments in the Civil Law Committee to ensure that the private data stays private and the public data stays public. So we're really fortunate to be able to work with her on this. So.
Okay. Questions? Any questions on House File 857? Members? From the public. Any closing statements?
No, I just appreciate your support. Thank you.
Chair will renew his motion to House File 857 to be re-referred to civil law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
House File 11. Oh, excuse me. House File 389. Representative O'Neill, you may move your own bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 389, recommended to pass and be referred to, I believe, the General Register. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
The General Register, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Marion O'Neill has moved her bill. Go ahead, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This morning I have before you, members, a very narrow civil forfeiture bill. It would reinstate the rights of a co-owner of a car in the cases of DUI where the second owner had it impounded because of a DWI, that they would actually have the ability to go before the courts and petition their case. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifier that can give more details about that and some of the history and the court case involved and why we are here today.
Okay, welcome, sir. State your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bruce Rivers. I am a criminal defense lawyer representing the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. And we're here today. This change in the law is in direct response to the State versus Lasse case. That was a case where a wife petitioned to have she's a joint owner in a vehicle. Her husband was convicted of multiple DUIs, and they said she didn't have any standing. This is really important, especially in situations where you have a either a college student who has multiple DUIs, or you have a spouse who had a second or third time DWI. And just all this does is allow the joint owner an opportunity to petition the court to get the car back and to preserve their property interest in it. willing to take any questions anybody has. They're pretty specific but small changes, and it doesn't grant any rights to anybody. It just gives them redress.
Okay, member. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. While I'm all for jumping with both feet on the perpetrator of the DWIs, their wife, significant other, not being able to go to work and things, I think is above and beyond what we should be doing. So thank you for bringing the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have asked Representative O'Neill this question in a previous committee, and I just want to ask it again. Representative O'Neill, it's your intention to keep this bill clean as it goes through the process, and this isn't going to be becoming the omnibus vehicle forfeiture bill. Is that correct?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, yes. That is our commitment to keep this bill clean. It is right now in the Senate on second reading, and so it is the commitment over there to also keep it clean. We want to just move this a very tiny bit, and so we can just have a day in court. We're just asking for the second owner to just have their day in court to be able to plead their case. We're not changing anything else about that. It's still you have to have clear and convincing evidence before the judge. Let the judge decide. It literally is just giving that person back their day in court.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, I'm hoping you are not willing to jump on Ms. Lossie, as she was the perpetrator in this offense. It was not Mr. Lossie. No. It was Ms. Lossie. It was the multiple DUI driver and not Mr. Lossie. This case happened in my community. I'm well aware of the case. I wanted to make the facts straight. I also want to get on the record that Mr. Lossie never did drive that vehicle, never was in that vehicle. He had his own vehicle that he drove, and he, as far as I could ever tell, every time I saw the previous vehicle Ms. Lossie drove, I never saw Mr. Lossie in that vehicle one time. So just getting some facts up. But my question is, in vehicle forfeitures, a lot of times, a lot of agencies don't forfeit the vehicle because, and a lot of county attorneys don't want to forfeit the vehicles because what they get from the vehicles in sales and what they have to divide the funds up, it costs them more to do it. They only use this if they absolutely need to. But we also have an issue where a lot of times a gentleman, and I've seen it with the females as well, they buy a car, they put it in grandma's name. Grandma's buying the insurance. Grandma's the innocent owner on this vehicle that's been involved in these situations, gets forfeited. Grandma's never seen the vehicle. Is this going to stop the forfeiture process?
This doesn't make changes to the forfeiture process other than the fact that the second owner can go before the court and with clear and convincing evidence plead their case and let the judge decide. Because, as you know, because this case happened in your district with Lossie versus 2007 Chevy Tahoe, that the Supreme Court determined that because there's vagueness in the law and the statute, that that person did not have standing. So the second owner did not have standing. That the only thing that it changes is clarifying the statute as it is now so that we can clarify that so that the second owner can have their day in court and can go before a judge, and then it's up to the judge to decide what happens after that.
Representative John.
Yeah, I understand that, and I think the second owner should have some standing. But I think this might go too far where it just basically with what this is doing, if there's a second owner on the vehicle, you're repealing the forfeiture statute, which is, I don't believe, your intent. What my county attorney has always done is required our officers to show that it's constructive ownership for the person driving the vehicle. Is it their personal belongings in the vehicle? Is it grandma's stuff in the vehicle that he was just borrowed that one day? Or is it his personal, the music, the stuff in the glove box, all consistent with what the driver is the principal owner of the vehicle? And I think if we go that route instead of this route, you're going to save the process for those who have a habitual problem of drinking and driving and taking their opportunity, by taking that vehicle, they're losing their opportunity to get into that vehicle and kill somebody on the roadway, and I think that might be a better approach.
Members, just for some clarification, this isn't an automatic get your vehicle back. All this does is allow the it's innocent owner defense. It allows the person to be able to petition into the court to give the defense and allow that defense to take place. You still have all the evidentiary procedures, and you can claim this and claim that and say that that's not true and that he or she has no right to that defense. But this allows them to make the defense, and it's something we've worked on for the last, I don't know how many years. We've got a lobbyist out there who's guaranteed me that this will stay clean and just allow a defense. So our chair would encourage support for the bill. All right.
Mr. Chair, you know, to ameliorate the member's concern, you know, if there are multiple DUIs, there's a presumption in the statute so that, you know, that you would really have to overcome that you didn't know that your family member was the one using the vehicle. This doesn't grant an automatic right. It just gives you standing to go to court. And everything that you had just suggested or talked about are issues for an evidentiary hearing that would go against your interest if you were the one petitioning.
Mr. Chair, we do have...
And we have somebody from the County Attorney's Association, I believe, would like to speak. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Small, and I am the Executive Director of the County Attorney's Association. And I just wanted to share with the members that the county attorney has reviewed this very narrow, very clean, very clear amendment to the forfeiture laws and would support it. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Considine, do you have a question?
No, Mr. Chair, you actually made my point. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Seeing no more questions, any comments from the public? Seeing none. You want to renew your motion, Representative O'Neill, unless you had a closing comment.
I just ask for your support, and I renew my motion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative O'Neill renews her motion to pass House File 389 to be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you.
And your next bill, House File 1148, you can move your bill, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 1148, recommended to be laid over for a possible inclusion in a later bill.
First of all, we should bring up an A2 amendment. Representative Hillstrom, this amendment didn't meet the deadline, correct? And it is a technical clarifying in nature, and historically, we've allowed this if they're not controversial, if it meets with your approval.
Mr. Chair, I actually spoke to Representative O'Neill, and I said we had no concern with hearing the amendment today.
Okay, thank you, Representative Hillstrom. With that, you want to move your amendment? A2?
Mr. Chair, I move the A2 amendment.
Okay. Having heard that, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, your bill is amended before us, Representative O'Neill. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, today I have before you we're going to move, hopefully if this bill passes and we get through this, move the HRO, the harassment restraining orders, closer to what the OFP system is. And I'm going to let the testifiers kind of talk about the history, but the reality is when a police officer rolls up to a scene and they can't see an HRO, they can't see a harassment restraining order on their system. So this moves this in that direction. We don't have a database built, but it allows the court to build a database or combine it with the OFP system. It does some permissive things. It also broadens the scope, members, so that the HRO can be served by all peace officers instead of just the sheriffs. It expands the hours in which the HRO can be served. It also creates a short form notification that's once the database is set up. So that the peace officers can serve that in lieu of personal service. And if the respondent wants the long form, it directs them of how to obtain it, either from a law enforcement agency or from the district court. It also, like I said, gives permission for the data network to be created so that we can have the systems together. And I know that that was the plan a decade ago, and it never seemed to come to fruition, and I believe it is time for the safety of the victims in order to move this forward. And with that, I'd like to turn over to my two testifiers.
Good morning. Your name and title, and begin.
Bree Adams-Bill. I'm the program director at the St. Paul and Ramsey County Domestic Abuse Intervention Project. And I'm here just to give start with some historical context of why these suggested changes are so important when it comes to victims of domestic violence, especially in the context of they do have the option of filing an order for protection. Over the last 10 years or so, domestic abuse advocates like me have worked with multiple victims of domestic violence needing a different option than the order for protection for a couple obstacles directly tied to the order for protection. One is that in order for a victim of domestic violence to petition the court for an order for protection, they need to specify the exact physical violence that has taken place in that relationship. And a lot of victims tend to not want to do that for a few reasons, not only the, I think, obvious humiliation and embarrassment of that, but also for fear of retaliation by the abuser that they're want to serve that order on. The abuser gets a copy of that, they see it, and it's now become your airing or dirty laundry. The second piece, why it's an obstacle, are specific to battered women that are mothers that want to file against their children's father. And here's the issue. In 2008, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that in order for protection, if there is a recognition of parentage, that that particular abusive father can ask for parenting time in an order for protection hearing. Cannot anywhere else, but can in an order for protection. There's a process already in place for an unadjudicated father to establish custody and parenting rights, and that's with family court. But essentially, in domestic abuse advocates' opinions, having this be tied to an order for protection has greatly impacted women's ability that are mothers to decide, do I protect my children and file an order for protection, or am I giving more access to a batterer that wouldn't normally have access? So a likely option in both of those scenarios that I just said is filing a harassment restraining order. Why? First, a harassment restraining order, you do not need to detail out the physical or sexual violence that's in the relationship. What you can talk about, what a victim can talk about, is the harassment that's always there. If you know anything about battering, it's always there. And they just have to talk about the unwanted, undesired acts, gestures by their batterer. That's enough. The second reason is a harassment restraining order cannot provide relief. It does not address custody. It does not address parenting time. It absolutely does not. But what it does do, similar to an order for protection, is restrain an abusive person to not have any contact. So, that being said, this is why I and advocates like me are in support of these changes, because we want the harassment restraining orders to match the order for protection in service, so that enforcement of that order can be done 24/7, and also violations can occur just as they do in the order for protection, when there's an order for protection filed. The other piece about it I want to just add is that it is crucial to victims of domestic violence and domestic abuse advocates that safety plan with them that there is the option of not just one entity to serve these orders. We need our patrol cops on the street serving these orders. We need our probation officers. We need jail staff. We work with them all the time to get service quickly, swiftly, immediately to those that need to be restrained. And we would like the same in this. So that's why we're in support of this bill.
Thank you very much. Questions yet? If none, your other testifier, your name and title, sir.
Thank you, sir. Sergeant David McCabe with the St. Paul Police Department. I have just some context. I have 5 years of experience working in our family violence unit. I currently work in our sex crimes unit. So I have some professional experience both serving harassment restraining orders, investigating order violations, and such. Currently, the process by statute is that harassing restraining orders can only be served by the county sheriff during the day, during the week, and excluding holidays. If an officer or even a sheriff's deputy encounters an unserved respondent of an HRO on a suspicious call or a call for service, they can't see that unserved order in a routine check that they normally would for other orders. And this, there is no state database that law enforcement can see these orders until they are served. This differs greatly from the order for protections. The service process for that is any law enforcement officer can serve an order for protection. It can be served by short form, which means it can be served 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And unserved order for protections can be seen through routine checks by law enforcement. As you just heard, these problems prevent law enforcement from effectively enforcing these court orders and addressing domestic violence. It also delays the time in which these orders can be served. It puts law enforcement in a position of not knowing valuable information when we arrive on the scene of one of the most deadly calls for law enforcement, domestic violence. It puts law enforcement in a position of not knowing valuable information where crime may be occurring in their presence. This process also creates a redundancy between police officers and sheriff's deputies, creates a cost of time, eliminates efficiency, and creates needless paper. In addition, this change will better serve anyone who seeks relief through the courts on an HRO as well. We are just seeking to have the service of order for protections match that of harassing restraining orders across the state. And in conclusion, law enforcement is asking the state to allow us and direct us through statute to serve and enforce harassing restraining orders, just as we already do with order for protections. This will allow us to better serve those who seek relief from the courts and protection by law enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This proposal came from my city, and I'm really grateful to Representative O'Neill for advancing it. I get the chance to work with Sergeant McCabe and Ms. Atlas Bill regularly in my non-legislative work, so many thanks to them. They do phenomenal work. And Ms. Atlas Bill and I have had many, many vigorous debates on domestic violence policy, so I'm really grateful to you for being here. So thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also wanted to thank Representative O'Neill. I'm also a co-author on this bill. I just wanted to speak a little bit about why service is so important. In my other role, I work exclusively with domestic violence cases. And essentially, you know, we hear from victims that why even go through this process? What is this paper even worth? Well, the paper is only really worth something to me as a prosecutor if it's served, because in order for us to charge somebody with a crime for violating the order, the easiest way to prove that they knew about the order is through service. And so I just wanted to touch on that piece about why that is so critical, because that's what puts the teeth to actually having an order. And then another piece to that is that we know that folks who are willing to violate court orders, that those cases are, when we look at lethality risk, are some of our highest risk cases. And so, you know, for someone to, they might know that they have an order against them, but if I can't prove it, I can't hold them accountable, and then we're in an even riskier place because there's no consequences for them violating the order. And so just one question I had, and I apologize, Representative O'Neill, I didn't have a chance to talk to you before our committee today. Just with the amendment, do we have an idea of when this information would be available? Because I've worked closely with the courts, and I know sometimes that can be burdensome. So all really great things, but we would need to make sure that this system is available in order to make this work.
Mr. Chair.
Whoever would like to. Representative William.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Becker Finn. So that is something that we've been discussing quite a bit with the BCA, and we're still waiting to hear back from the courts. And so what this language is doing is giving permission to move forward. And then we're going to be working with hopefully OJP, who actually funded the OFP database. And then we're still trying to figure out, can it be incorporated in the OFP database, or does it need to be a separate database? So those are all fantastic questions. We are still working them out. We met last Friday and hashed out a lot of things, but we're just not quite sure how that is going to work. We need to hear back from the courts. But this is the first step in giving the permission, and we can move forward and then ask the courts to, again, let us know what needs to have happen, and then we'll work on a granting process, hopefully through OJP. Hopefully it won't be as expensive as last time, and I just don't have all the answers. I would love to have it snapped on tomorrow and be available. It's going to take a little bit of time to build and to put together, but that is the very next step. This is the first step so that we can actually allow it to happen.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you. Just to follow up real quick, it's a great bill. I really want to see it actually take effect. So I thank you for your work on that. And just I don't know that anyone from the courts or OGP is here today, but just to continue to keep the pressure on that so we can make this become law. So thank you.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I want to thank you for bringing this. My career in law enforcement, HROs were the biggest nightmare we had. Because if it was in another county, we had to wait for the faxes, for them to fax the order so we'd actually see what the order is so we could see what to do. So I'm glad this is coming forward. I take it you've requested a fiscal note because I do see a lot of costs in here, unfortunately. And I'd like to say I do want to see this go forward. But I think my concern is it probably won't go forward till Minlars is done. That nightmare that they've been doing over there for, I don't know how many years, seems like a decade. Have you heard when Minlars, any idea when Minlars is going to be done so they could incorporate this in?
Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. So as I understand it, the OFP part of it is not in Minlars, unless I misunderstood that, but I believe Minlars is supposed to be done at the end of this year, but I'm not on that committee, so I might be incorrect in that, but in talking with the department, I think they had said the end of this year. But I believe this system would hopefully be incorporated in the current OFP system, and if not, then they would have to build a separate system, which, of course, would be a little more cumbersome, but I can tell you that when they did the OFP system, it was about $1 million, and they did get a grant in order to do that. So hopefully there will be very little cost in the general fund money and maybe none. We're hoping to do that through a granting process.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I'm not sure how this system works. All I know is that when we'd run a name, that information would pop up. So it's got to be tied into Minlar somehow. And I don't see any problem adding in the HRO into the restraining order database. It might be fairly simple to do. At least I'm hoping that's it. But it's going to be the bigger problem to be at the local level with all the data entry they have to do. Because the harassment restraining orders probably outnumbered the OFPs 10 to 1. So it's going to be a lot of information that's going to have to be entered. But thanks for bringing this forward. It cleared up a lot of issues.
Okay, members, any questions, any input from the public? Okay, with that, the chair will lay over House File 1148 as amended for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Representative O'Neill. Meeting adjourned.